This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
It's Second Saturday, and I am your host, Elizabeth Anderson, for the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. We have a very interesting book to discuss today. It is the memoir, My Butch Career, by Esther Newton. We have a panelist who I believe is on the line, Jonda. Hi, Jonda.
Hello. Happy to be here.
And Jonda Boyce has been on the show several times before as a panelist, so she knows the ropes, and she knows that I usually start with a question. I want to ask you, Jonda, why you decided to get a master's degree in women's studies?
Oh, I had had the opportunity to be in on the ground floor of Southeast Missouri State University's Women's Studies program as an undergraduate, and my mentors there said, you should do this. We wish we could have done this. This was 1992, and so I applied around for graduate schools in women's studies.
You also have a law degree, so how do those two work together?
Actually, while I was in that women's studies program, which was at The Ohio State University, several of my colleagues were going on to law school, and I think one or two were doing a dual degree, but I didn't think it was for me. I actually waited about 16, 18 years after my master's degree to go to law school. That was a decision because I wanted to change careers and kick some behind and make some differences.
I really wanted you for this book club because you have a history of activism and you have been at many important events here in Kansas City. Could you talk a little about your activism?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to, is that I felt like a law degree would help my activism. So that's why I went back at age 38, back maybe 10 years ago. I was in law school, and then I decided to come back to my home state of Missouri after law school, after being away for 18 or so years from Missouri. Here in Kansas City, I pretty quickly got involved with ACLU and with Stand Up KC, which is the Fight for 15 in a Union, but also with the LGBTQ community. So I have participated in the TransMar and various other events around Kansas City to support the right to protest, which I think is really important in the current era. That's one of the things that I do through ACLU, is legal observing of protests and making sure that police are treating the right to protest properly as per our Constitution. I could go on and on, but I certainly know we want to get into the book, but I'm happy to talk about activism throughout.
We do want to talk about the book. I did not come out until late in life, as you know. And so second wave feminism was well underway, and I've never had a firm grasp on it. What does it mean to you?
I love studying the history of feminism and of LGBTQ communities, and so that's why I found this book fascinating. When you asked me to consider being on this panel, it took me about 30 seconds to decide that I would very happily devour this book and be on the panel. Whether Ms. Newton was on the show or not, this is a great book for us to discuss at this time. I love looking backward. Now, I too was not involved in the 70s feminism that she discusses in the book. I was born in 1970, but I studied it as a women's studies student. Her contribution to queer studies, I'll call it, although I'm happy to ask her what she thinks about that term, her contribution to queer studies is early and fascinating. I hope folks will look her up and they'll find that she's got a few readings that you could look up on her website where you can hear her read from the book, or I found a YouTube video of a drag performer reading her work, Mother Camp, which came out of her dissertation. The drag queen was doing a reading of her Mother Camp sometime in the last few years. So, not sure I answered your question, but certainly I'm very much a student of feminist history, lesbian history, and queer history.
That was an excellent answer. What interested me as I read the book was, we've done other books. Mark Segal's book about queer history, Eminent Outlaws by Christopher Bram, The Lesbian South by Jamie Harker, The L Word by Bonnie Morris. And it's amazing how some of these events, they're not in mainstream history. You don't learn about them in high school or in regular college classes. I want to ask Esther if she joins us about the Miss America protest, the second Congress to unite women with the Lavender Menace there, demonstrations for women, more women artists, Gay Pride 1971 in New York City. That was very early. My first Gay Pride was here in Kansas City in 1993. So I just think how much history I was not at.
I really enjoyed, last summer I had a chance to take in several exhibits about Stonewall 50 that showed lesbians, gay men, trans folks, and various others in the community. At the New York Public Library last May, I was able to get to New York before everybody descended for Stonewall 50 in June and see that exhibit. And I've also recently finished The Stonewall Reader, which actually came out of that exhibit. It's by the curators of that exhibit. So this was a great companion to my Stonewall Reader and my Stonewall 50 tour last year for her to talk about the academic side, although she was involved in activism, as you just mentioned, for example, involved as she was in the Miss America protests, that type of thing. But the academic side was, what do we do with something that academia considers a side issue, or that they might just say is your personal politics, and how, you know, how did that morph over her career from the late 60s when she got out of graduate school to now when universities have queer studies departments and chairs in queer studies.
I was in academia, and I want to ask Esther why she stuck it out, because she faced so much discrimination. And I taught college full-time in the late 70s, and I didn't face what she did, but then I don't know how common it was.
Mm-hmm. I know that my professors at Southeast Missouri State University, for example, in 1990, were very closeted. The lesbians that I knew, and I knew a couple of lesbian professors that were out to me, were not talking about it. You know, they knew, as the book mentioned, that it could be career suicide, that it wasn't considered compatible, even if you weren't studying areas that they consider marginal or personal, as she was doing with Mother Camp, studying camp and drag. Even if that's not what you were studying, if you were studying something more acceptable to the academy, I did get from those two women that I knew that you didn't want your sexuality to be known, that it was still something at that kind of college, which is, for those listeners who don't know, it's a regional state school in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, that was not something that would do well for promotion and tenure, for example.
I remember when I was in a very, very conservative college. Grove City College is still one of the most conservative colleges in the United States. And in about 1973, I want to say, our European history professor just disappeared. He wasn't in class. We were all upset. It was Dr. Sterrett. And we couldn't figure out where he'd gone. And it turned out that rumor had it that they'd found out he was gay and told him to leave campus immediately. He didn't even have time to pack up his office. Very frightening times. And
that is shameful.
It is. Do you read much nonfiction? Does this kind of book thrill you, or do you read mostly romances?
Memoir is my favorite, although this is a romance too.
It is.
My Butch Career, a memoir by Esther Newton. I think, you know, one can enjoy it if one enjoys romances as well. I appreciated her frankness about the tortured 20s and 30s of a lesbian and a culture that's so disapproving, or, you know, tortured even now, I'm sure, because, you know, relationships difficulties are timeless. So no, memoir is actually my favorite, although I do read lesbian fiction and a wide variety of nonfiction. As I mentioned, the most recent LGBT book I read was Stonewall Reader, but I also am rereading The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith right now. I'm enjoying this inward homebound period for all of the pleasures that it brings.
My most recent read was a romance, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It was so well written and so good. And before that, historical fiction. And before that, I would say general dramatic fiction. But every now and then, I want to pick up a nonfiction book because I love to learn. And these are times that I wouldn't otherwise know about. I do remember that when the second wave began, Abortion was illegal. Women could not get credit cards or mortgages in their own names. I remember that. And husbands could not be arrested for raping their wives. I remember one time when my then husband and I went to buy a car, and the salesman would only talk to Marshall, and he said, "She will get what you're saying faster than I will. If you don't speak to her, we're leaving immediately." Which, this was in Oklahoma, and the guy was just kind of flummoxed. So times have changed, but some of the things in the book that she describes are still happening. I believe we have Esther on the line. Hello, Esther.
Hi.
Jonda and I have been talking, but we, of course, want to talk with the author. She was talking about her women's studies degree, why activism is important to her, and we were talking about what we like to read. I really enjoyed what you said about making peace with the biographer, and you're a butch intellectual who likes to write. Can you talk a little bit about making peace with the biographer?
Well, I think in my case, it has a lot to do with my training as an academic in history and anthropology, and how even when you write academically, you're still shaping the material. But when you're writing about yourself, I get caught. Well, obviously, I got through it because of the being able to write the memoir, but you get caught between a desire to get everything, every detail and everything right chronologically and all that stuff, and telling a story. Yeah, and telling a story is not the same thing.
I identify with that so much because I've been an editor for 35 years. And so
there you go.
When I and I started out in academia. I was an assistant professor, but when I try to write, I find myself self-editing and lapsing into more formal language even when it's not appropriate.
Right.
So
I
identified with that. You're a cultural anthropologist who's been in academia. And I think I know the answer to this, having read your book. But if you had it to do all over again, would you still be a professor?
I think so. I think I was cut out for that. I was very bookish. The one thing I didn't know was, could I teach? I mean, that was the big unknown. But I didn't even face, when I went to graduate school, we didn't have to teach. You know, there weren't any teaching assistantships, and you just went through, and it was still all books and research and that stuff, and I just had no idea if I would even like teaching. But fortunately, I did, and I really think that teaching is a noble profession. No, I would do it the same way again.
That's the answer I had arrived at by the end of the book. I did very much enjoy the advice you were given in teaching your first class of undergraduates, and that is that you knew more about anthropology than they did.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Very helpful advice, yes. Of course, when I started teaching, I was only 28, you know, so I wasn't that much older than they were. Of course, to them, it probably seemed like I was ancient, but perspective changes with time.
John, the early chapters, Esther, about your life and your three fathers. John, can you talk a little about those?
One of the questions that I had about the early chapters that I thought we might discuss was your high school experience and dressing. I mean, the book is called My Butch Career, and I found that fascinating, how you address that in various segments of your life up to age 40 or 41 when the memoir ends. But you talked about how if you wore the pants that you were able to buy at a men's clothing store, you know, that you would be seen a certain way, and that women, to be proper students, had to wear a certain kind of skirt. It seems like clothing has been a part of women's and lesbian struggles since the 1800s. Do you think that we've evolved beyond that by now?
Yes, but it's not resolved. I mean, this is something, when I would talk to my graduate students about job interviews, and I would always say, well, you know, what are you going to wear? And that was funny, but it's not completely funny. But I found that they were more comfortable presenting themselves in some version of how they felt comfortable than I did.
when I was going for job interviews. I mean, the job that I stayed in for most of my life, I was 30, you know, when I interviewed for it, and I still wore a suit and pumps. You know, it was obligatory, really. I think there's more latitude now, yes, but it's still a big issue.
Especially in certain professions.
Yes, some more than others.
Yes, for instance, I can't imagine going into banking in extremely casual dress. I wouldn't go in and...
True, absolutely. I was thinking within academia even, there are some fields that are more flexible than others. I wasn't thinking about banking.
I agree.
Yeah.
In the early chapters, you're a pioneer for many reasons. Today, many families are complicated and have complex structures with step relatives and in-laws and two mothers, two fathers. You had three fathers, which I found fascinating.
Yes. In the last few months, I actually found out who my biological father was. And in the end, it was so easy. Through the miracle of DNA, I did 23andMe, and as soon as I got the results back, these first cousins that I'd never heard of popped up, and within a few hours, I knew who this guy was that I had been this huge mystery all of my life. It was quite a moment.
I have friends who have done that and have found sisters and cousins and relatives they had no idea they had. It's
exactly. Well, I thought they were out there, actually, because I knew that he had had other children, and they might still be alive because they were younger than I was. So I thought they were maybe out there, but it's a whole other thing meeting them. And now I'm corresponding with my sister, who lives in London.
Wow.
And she sent me photographs of my biological father, and it's been an amazing experience.
John and I talked about the fact that you had been at so many seminal events in LGBT history. The Miss America protest, the Second Congress to Unite Women with the Lavender Menace, the demonstration at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for More Women Artists, Gay Pride 1971 in New York City. Did you know at the time that those events would be so historic?
In a way, I did, yes. There was such an incredible excitement about those that time and those events. I think we were aware that we were making history, at least to a degree. Of course, people get caught up in the moment and, you know, the excitement of the moment. But although, especially the Lavender Menace demonstration, to me, that should be maybe not as important as Stonewall, but pretty darn important, because that really broke through the barrier between straight women and gay women. Not that you don't still have to break through it, but just in such a big way. And this is why I love being a historian and why it's so important to me that feminism and lesbian feminism and the transgender movement and all these things not be made invisible. You're always struggling against that, oh, you're not really part of the important stuff, you know?
And, do you mind for our listeners explaining what the Lavender Menace that we're discussing was, this demonstration?
No, I wouldn't. There was something that came out of the tremendous fervor of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s called the Second Congress to Unite Women. And I should say that now, in the National Organization of Women, which was leading the feminist fight at that point, was very homophobic, because Betty Friedan, who was kind of the founder of NOW, was very homophobic. And she had referred to lesbians as the Lavender Menace, the idea that lesbians getting involved in feminism would mean that all of feminism would be tainted or painted with that brush of lesbianism. And some people who were on the board of NOW were actually expelled. So this Second Congress to Unite Women was supposedly talking about women's issues, but lesbians were never mentioned. So this group, this ad hoc group of women who called themselves the Lavender Menace, interrupted. They turned out the lights in the auditorium and got up on stage and interrupted and said that you can't ignore lesbians. We're here. We're part of feminism. And the whole conference was derailed, and the rest of it all was workshops talking about these issues. It really broke through that barrier between straight women and lesbians by lesbians insisting, no, you have to accept us as women and as being feminist. Not that you have to be a woman to be a feminist, actually, but that's a whole other issue. I mean, because to me, feminism is an ideology. It's not all women are feminists, obviously. So, but that you had to accept lesbian issues as feminist issues. Let's put it that way.
I love what you say in your book about feminism is not a bias. It is, in the academic context, a scholarly perspective motivated by values, as is all scholarship. I think that nails it down.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I can't tell if I'm talking to Elizabeth or Jonda.
We should probably introduce ourselves. Jonda, I'm going to ask you to talk about some of the people that Esther met in her book that you mentioned before. Jill Johnston was one.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, we also were speaking of different genres, and I hope it's okay, Esther. I proclaimed it as a memoir, but certainly also if you enjoy romance, you would enjoy this one as well. You had some very interesting people in your life, didn't you?
Yes. Well, being in New York, there were other very important centers like Chicago, San Francisco, and so on, but lots of, in those years, people who were very important to the different movements, actions that happened, demonstrations. Being in New York was sort of this cauldron of activism and action. And I was lucky to live in New York. I am a New Yorker. I was lucky to live there for many years.
I, of course, never met Jill Johnston, but I have been in meetings with someone who, you mentioned she was egocentric, brilliant, imperious, and intense and creative woman, always on the brink of a flip out. And you had asked during a meeting, is it negative energy to bring up a question or propose a different point of view, which seems eminently reasonable?
She didn't like that. She didn't like that. But this was a problem, an endemic problem in lesbian feminism, that the whole problem of structure. I don't know if either of you has read the article by, of course, I forget who right now, but The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And because we didn't believe in hierarchy or leaders, all kinds of problems came from that. Good things came from that, but all kinds of problems came from that. And so in this group I was in with Jill Johnston, there couldn't be any acknowledgement that it was her group, and she was a very imperious person. Creative, amazing person, wonderful writer.
I enjoyed your description when you were in Paris, in France, of the two groups that had two different methodologies.
Yes.
I identified with that, too. I've been in each group at different times. For readers that perhaps haven't read the book, do you feel that second wave feminism did make the world better, or has made the world better?
Oh, without a doubt. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Just like gay liberation made the world much better. It's not that we couldn't lose it all. We're in the process of going backwards right now. But yes, at least we know what it could be.
Definitely.
What the world could be. Yeah. It's much better.
And you just answered one of my questions, because things are going backwards in many respects. We need to take a break. Linda, our producer and sound engineer, has picked a song specifically for this book.
There's a butch witch walking right toward me, with pliers in her pocket and a spell on her key ring. Her hair is cropped and spiky, and her nails are cut short. In the pouch around her belt, she carries quartz and mugwort. She watches the moon, and in goddess she believes. She has cinnamon and lavender up her sleeve, her plaid flannel sleeve, if you know what I mean.
This is Elizabeth Anderson. It's the Santa Moran Radio Book Club, and we are talking to panelist Jonda Boyce and author Esther Newton about Esther's memoir, My Butch Career. Esther, I want to ask you about the common slur that a butch is just a lesbian trying to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
You address that so well through passages about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, which I enjoyed so much. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I really connected that, especially how I think about Gertrude Stein, with what I wrote, which was that up until feminism, I thought of myself as an exceptional woman, that I was different from other women. And that's definitely how Gertrude Stein thought of herself, and she articulated that as, thank goodness I wasn't born a woman. But she never tried to pass as a man, and except for a couple of occasions in drag, I've never tried to pass as a man either, although I am frequently misgendered. By frequently, I mean, you know, once a week at least, sometimes more. I think that's a very complicated issue, and I tried to address that in the introduction to my book about what's the relationship to trans men. Is that where you wanted me to go with this? Or
not necessarily, but I thought you handled that subject so deftly in the introduction. John Doe, what about you?
Oh, yes. And actually, I would be happy to have you speak a little bit about your feeling about butch and trans, if you don't mind, Ms. Newton.
I think that probably in the future there's going to be more overlap. Like, I know people now who used to consider themselves butch, who maybe they had top surgery, but now, and they might call themselves trans, but they didn't take hormones, for example. And they're occupying some kind of middle space. That's not where I'm coming from, really, because of my age and my history. Being butch, for me, claiming that identity, which took a long time for me, it's a way of living in a woman's body where you can feel powerful, where I could feel powerful and comfortable in my own skin. But I've thought about these issues a lot, and they're very complicated and vexed.
At least young people have more visible LGBTQ people of all kinds, butch, trans men, trans women, femmes, all sorts. And there are indeed butches to look up to. You write so beautifully. There's one passage that just thrilled me. We are all swathed in symbols, wearing our past like feathers stuck in an exotic headdress. A southern accent or a sweater that shouts out working class or dyke or French. Yet love in the end eludes even sophisticated explanations. And I think that says it all.
Yes. Yes, we live in a very complicated world of symbols. That's what anthropology is all about. And love in the end is a mystery still.
It is.
It is.
You had talked a bit about, and before you were on the line, I mentioned Mother Camp, your work from graduate school and published, you know, once you were a professor. Speaking about your attraction to female impersonation as related to your butch persona?
Yes. Well, first of all, Jonda, thanks for sending me those photographs of Skip. I should say Skip Arnold was what anthropologists call my best informant and my closest informant. Skip Arnold, a drag queen who was a very big personality in the gay world in Kansas City in the 50s and 60s, somebody that I loved very much and who really captivated me. His performances, I thought, were amazing. As I wrote, I felt my attraction to drag, which was pretty immediate. I didn't realize this at the time, but in retrospect, I see that, well, in a way I did recognize it, that they showed me that gender is cultural. It's not innate. And that you can, you know, put on the tits and the dress and perform not as a woman, but as the persona of a woman, if that makes any sense. And I was so used to performing as the persona of a woman, without really feeling like a woman, what I thought a woman should feel like, that it just was not a leap for me at all to understand what was going on. And I've always loved theater, too. So
you explained it so well, if I can quote you. Drag was the milieu of that same gender dysphoria that had tormented me, where a kindred's pain was spun into connection, laughter, and creative gold. I, too, had practiced female impersonation of a different kind, most intensely during my high school and college years. Again, it certainly resonated with me. I was a tomboy growing up. I happened to stumble across in American Anthropology book reviews of Mother Camp, December 2018 issue, and all the reviews, it was so interesting to read them.
You're talking about the reviews that came out a couple of years ago?
Yes.
Yes, well, sort of a protege of mine organized that, because when Mother Camp came out, it wasn't reviewed. It was reviewed maybe by two people. One I didn't see, the other one was a Pam by this closeted gay man who hated the idea of identity politics. And that was it. And it just dropped like a stone. But over the years, because it was kept in print by the University of Chicago Press, and I really owe them for that, but they kept it in print, sells every year, it sells a certain amount of copies, and it's a lot of years now. And people started to read it. And one of the people who read it was Judith Butler, who then discusses in Gender Trouble this epiphany moment when she read my writing about gender being a role that could be performed. That was kind of the key moment for her. And so then other people picked up on that, and it was like, well, what is this Mother Camp? And so it became this pioneering work in gender studies, gender and sexuality studies. And I'm very happy about that. And I love those reviews that, you know, better late than never, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Well, another work of yours, Margaret Mead Made Me Gay, Personal Essays, yeah. Public Ideas. I had to laugh when I read, Margaret Mead once told me that I would never be a real anthropologist until I did foreign field work. And yeah. You talk about how anthropology was dominated by the romance of the pith helmet, you know, and I'm sure Indiana yeah. Jones movies don't help. But,
right. But
you actually met Margaret Mead.
Oh, sure. All graduate students of my generation at least saw her, you know, if they went to the annual conventions. She was quite the presence at the conventions when I was a graduate student. But people who were on my committee and professors that I knew her, and yes, I met her. In fact, I went to her apartment once. That's when she told me I would never be a real anthropologist unless I did foreign field work. So in a sense, my going to France fulfilled that, because it wasn't in the jungle, but it was certainly foreign to me.
Very true.
Yes, she was. If only I had known that she was bisexual and Ruth Benedict was a lesbian. If only I had known that. Uh-huh. It would have meant so much to me, but of course I didn't know it because it was hidden.
Some of the discrimination that you described, it hurt, as I read about the tenure battle being fired yeah. by one university and the discrimination. Frankly, it's one reason I got out of academia. I just didn't want to deal with turf battles, tenure and all that. I was amazed at how you battled through. What made you keep going?
I wasn't qualified to do anything else, really. You know, and I had to work. But really, while I fulfilled the requirements of the job, during the years I was in France, those years, I was very alienated. That's why I thought, I'm going to write, I'm going to be a novelist, I'm going to do these other things. And because I had been mistreated. And also, I had a lot of critique of the academic world, which I still have lots of critiques, just because I spent my life in it. I mean, who better equipped to be critical? And I am very critical. Even worse things have happened. The whole corporatization of academia is horrifying to me.
I swear sometimes the administration outnumbers the faculty.
Got it.
Jonda, I want to ask if you have any questions for Esther at this point.
I wanted to comment on what you two were just discussing. That I feel like, as I said earlier, I stand on Esther Newton's shoulders as I read my Butch career. I'm very eager to watch the forthcoming film, Esther Newton Made Me Gay. But now, you know, in contrast to your struggles
for recognition, to make sure that, that you could get back into academia when things were turning a bit. Now, as I started a new career in around 2012 in the legal field, they're recruiting for lesbian lawyers. They're recruiting for, you know, LGBT folks in big firms and corporate counsel. It's considered diversity recruiting, and I have been stunned, because I've been out for 30 years now as a lesbian, that now it's something that I should put really high up on the resume to make sure that I am noticed as a lesbian lawyer.
I love it.
Yes, it's shocking still. I've been at it 8 years, and I just keep hearing more and more about that, and that's because of groundbreaking women like you.
Ah, thank you.
I love to ask my older lesbian friends how they heard about a certain women's music album or a festival or a book. And so I'm intrigued about the tennis player when you were young, I believe a minor, who gave you the Well of Loneliness in a paper bag. How did you come to get the Well of Loneliness in a paper bag again?
She was a classmate of mine who ultimately, I found out, went into the prison world as a, I don't know what they call those jobs, but somehow in administration and corrections. I'm sure she was a lesbian, but she had somehow come across, gotten a copy of it. Oh, you know, a lot of, it came out in 1928, and I guess 29 here, and it was, for many people, it was the only book about lesbianism they ever knew about or read, and I don't know, she swiped her mother's copy or whatever it was, but she definitely saw a kindred spirit in me, and she handed it to me and said, you know, read this. But then when her mother found out about it, she turned around and blamed me, which, not the mother, my so-called friend. But as I wrote in my book, that was an era of state-sponsored terrorism toward gay people. And so I think we have to forgive the people who, you know, like the people in the armed forces, for example, who were tormented for weeks and weeks and finally, to try to get out of it, turned in their friends. You know, it was sort of like that on the high school level. You have to forgive them.
You mentioned that your ex-communist parents had especially hated Nixon because of his red baiting. Your ire was aroused by capitalism, corporations' hopeless state of the male-dominated world. And I have to ask, how much have things really changed?
Back in the days of lesbian feminism and even the anti-war movement, which I participated in to a degree, against the Vietnam War, you know, we really thought we were going to create a revolution. We were going to, overthrow capitalism and bring in a new era. And a lot of lesbian feminists thought, you know, we're going to bring back the matriarchy, and none of that happened. So power is resilient. And power structures are very hard to, you know, and they tend to, especially in America with our consumerist culture, they tend to turn even very radical movements into consumer goods and stuff they can sell. For example, the Me Too movement, which, thank goodness for it, but it's not really connected to feminism and the work that feminists have done over the decades on the structures of the patriarchy. It's just not real. It's like some bad actors kind of thing, and a lot of them, even, maybe. But it's the structure that gives them the power to do that stuff they're doing.
Yes.
And that's not really being critiqued by the Me Too movement, which is sort of being turned into a hashtag, like trying to fight with Jell-O. Just power structures are always morphing into new forms, but that doesn't mean that Elizabeth asked me before, well, are things better now? Yes, they are. They are better. And if you live long enough, you live long enough to see, you know, that time when I had to go for a job interview in my suit and pumps and pretend I was something I wasn't. That's changed quite a lot. There's lots of things women can do. Maybe there's going to be a woman vice president. It's not revolution, but it is progress.
It's incremental.
It's incremental, yes. And you can see how we can so easily lose momentum with the administration that's in power now.
Mm-hmm. One reason we do this show, and Jonda knows this, is because so much of LGBT literature, nonfiction and fiction, poetry, it's marginalized. It's not out in the mainstream. Readers don't find it. And I would encourage everyone to read My Butch Career. One question I have is there going to be a sequel, since this takes you up to about 1980?
Well, maybe, but so it took me 20 years to do that one, and I don't think I have another 20 years, but I'm not working full-time now. In fact, I'm not working at all, so I have a lot more time. So that remains to be seen, I guess I have to say.
I understand that your dogs keep you active.
They do, yes.
Would you explain to listeners the difference between a pet person and a dog person? I'd love that.
Dog people are people who are involved in the world of dog sports, basically, or they might be involved in the world of dog rescue. In other words, they're involved with dogs in more than this is my family pet.
Mm-hmm. Which is still important, but...
Oh, very important. Yeah, absolutely important, but it's different.
We are Facebook friends, and I have enjoyed in the past your posts very much about agility and training.
Oh, thank you.
Before we go, I want to mention our producer and sound engineer, Linda, has been to Carefree, and it's a community in Florida, and I understand you live there, and she's spoken very highly of it.
Yeah, it is. I was there last week in February, and it's kind of like unreal when you just walk around, you know, and you see so many women out with their pets walking, and everybody says hello to you and talks to you, and everybody's welcoming. It's kind of like a utopia, but probably have to be there longer than a week to really get the full effect of it.
Right.
But I was there during the Olympics that were going on, so everybody was in pretty much party mood to and welcome them. So it was a fun.
You have to come back. It's really, it's a very nice place to live, and it's a nice place to visit.
It is. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And I appreciate so much you being on the show today. We're running out of time, so I just want to know, if someone wants to find out more about you, where should they go?
They can go to my website, which is Esther, is spelled E-S-T-H-E-R, Newton.com, I guess. Yeah, it is a .com. Esther-Newton.com. They can find that out, and they can find out about the movie that's being made about me at EstherNewtonMadeMeGay.com. I haven't been to that's the new name.
I would encourage listeners to also go to Esther Newton Made Me Gay on Facebook. That's where I saw a brief interview with you regarding what's going to be in the forthcoming film, and so Esther Newton Made Me Gay is on Facebook.
Jonda, thank you for that.
Thank you both so much, and we're out of time. I appreciate so much both of you being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.